On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, today we have something a little different on the bookshelf, a fun interview, a chance to talk about what I consider one of the great television shows of all time. And with us is Scott Ryan, who is the author of Moonlighting, an Oral History. It's from Fayetteville Mafia Press. And Scott is the author of 30-something at 30, The Last Days of Letterman, Scott Luck Stories, and he's the managing editor of the Twin Peaks magazine, The Blue Rose. He also once played David Addison in the 1988 homemade VHS classic Spoof Lighting. We're delighted to have Scott with us today on the bookshelf. And like I was telling Scott before we started, that I really enjoyed his book very much. And one of the reasons is that I am a huge fan and always have been of Moonlighting. And obviously you are too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was definitely the most influential show on me as a teenager. And I've never stopped loving Dave and Maddie, that's for sure.
When the show first started, this was the first major role for a guy who became a huge movie star before the show was even over. And his co-star was someone who had started out as a movie star and had been a model and was making her way into television. When you first saw the show, had you ever heard of Cybill Shepherd before, or was that kind of a new entity for you?
Say they were both new to me because I was 15 years old when I saw the show the first time. It really was David Addison that just sparked my interest in the show. I was in high school and a smart mouth, and to see David Addison with his quips. You know, when you were explaining how he became such a movie star and was a no one before, I think like the only thing that might be close to it is maybe George Clooney on ER.
Yeah.
Where someone just exploded and became one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy to think what happened to Bruce Willis during the run of Moonlighting.
The character that he played as David Addison was the epitome of every smart aleck that's ever been. And there's a lot of us that are out there. Some of us are in recovery and some of us are. He had such a wonderful attitude toward life. The idea that life was meant to be enjoyed and you really kind of wanted your boss to be like David Addison was. Happily enough, they didn't have to worry about making money because they were a tax write-off. When all that changed, then the dynamics of the workplace changed for all of the people that were working at Blue Moon Detective Agency, but it never completely went away, right?
No, I mean, and that was what the show was all about. You had an uptight person and a loose person, and they fall in love and become the greatest TV couple of all time, and mostly because they weren't right for each other. I mean, that is why they're such a great couple, because they are horrible for each other.
They're the kind of people that never, ever, ever should fall for each other. And yet, how many times in life do we see this very same thing happen? People who are attracted to each other because of the situation in which they find themselves, and because the other person is so different from them that they kind of wonder, what would it be like, you know, for David Addison, who's always been a scruffy little guy, you know, in his own mind anyway. He hit the jackpot when he got this job at the Blue Moon Detective Agency, and now he's got this gorgeous boss who is around all the time, and even though he drives her crazy and she drives him crazy, nonetheless, he admires her for what she has been able to do in her career, and he wants to be successful too, but he doesn't want to give away too much of himself in order to be successful, and she kind of envies that, doesn't she?
Yeah, and she was the boss, and that was very different at that time in the 80s,
right,
to have the female character be the one that was running it. And I think there are a lot of ways that Moonlighting was ahead of its time, but maybe none more than that. All the other detective shows, it was always the man that was in charge.
Right.
And that battle of the sexes between Dave and Maddie is what made that show so very popular for me.
Now, there was one other show that's kind of that has some similarities to it, and that was Remington Steele, where there is a woman boss, but the gimmick with that show was she pretended she wasn't the boss. And so when this guy walks in the door and everybody thinks he's Remington Steele, she goes with it. But in this particular show, she actually does own the business, and so she's concerned about whether they make a profit. And every episode, she's dealing with, are we going to make payroll? You know, we're a detective agency. We've got to be a successful agency to stay in business, and it's the only business she has left out of all these other ones that her accountant encouraged her to buy as tax write-offs, and then he took off for a country where he wouldn't have to, able to be brought back to the United States to face the fact that he stole all her money.
Yeah, and it sounds like a crazy show, but the truth was that really wasn't why you tuned in. It wasn't about the plots at all. It was the silliness. It was the chases, the rhymes, and just the sexual chemistry between Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd.
There was this tension going on, a real palpable tension, and the writing was extraordinarily good. And you interviewed 30 people for the book. You were the only major person you didn't get to interview was somebody who said he would be available and then wasn't, and that's Bruce Willis. But you talked to everybody else, and they're all pretty honest, too. I mean, Cybill Shepherd kind of takes her lumps when she talks about how things got complicated for her when she became pregnant with twins. Really was an inconvenient thing to happen at the time that it had happened in the show. And dealing with it was very complicated. But I think the person that was really kind of a surprise for me was when you talked to the creator of the show, and he talked, that's Glenn Gordon Caron, and he talks about what it was like having this wonderful freedom to write these crazy, crazy plots and have, at least at first, relatively unlimited budgets to do whatever thing that they thought up.
Yeah, and that was really what made me want to do this book. I have wondered my whole life, why hasn't there been another show like Moonlighting? There's certainly been shows that you have two characters that maybe you want to get together. But there had never been a show that's as creative as Moonlighting, where one week it's a Shakespeare show, one week it's a black and white episode, one week they're singing and dancing. And I didn't understand, why doesn't everyone do this? And it basically was because there was nobody running the insane asylum. I mean,
yeah.
They pretty much just let them go because the show of Moonlighting was a test case for ABC to own their own series. That wasn't happening at that time. You know, now Netflix owns all the shows that they make. HBO
right.
owns them. It's no big deal for the platform that's playing the show to own the show. But at the time, in 1985, that was very new. So this was an experiment for ABC, and the ratings were going great, and they were making a ton of money, so they didn't care.
Right.
Now, eventually, things get off, you know, gets a little crazy, and ABC starts to care. But in the beginning, it was just money for everyone.
One of the things that surprised me that I learned from reading your book, Moonlighting and Oral History, is that the guy who was in charge was writing so much of the scripts and that they were never on time, or very seldom were they on time for the director. And people who haven't done television or people who haven't done plays, even though they're kind of different, they do have obviously a lot of similarities. The role of the director in a television show or a movie is different than the role of a producer. The producer comes up with the money, but as a general rule, they don't tell the director how to do anything. The director has to go by the script. And if you don't have the script and you're starting rehearse and you're starting to actually film things and you don't know how it's going to end, this is stressful for the director, and it's certainly difficult on the actors, and particularly with Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd, who are in the vast majority of the scenes and have piles and piles of dialogue to learn. This is a stress-inducing thing, right?
Yeah, and one of my favorite stories that the writers tell is they were doing an episode, and the Dan Loria, who played the dad on The Wonder Years, if anyone remembers
right.
that
yeah,
show.
Absolutely.
He's in it, and he's playing a cop. And he's just playing a regular cop, and he's in this episode. You know, they're filming it for 7 days, and then they come to him and say, oh, you're the killer. And he's like, what? When did I become the killer? And they're like, just now. And he's like, but I didn't play it that way. And they're like, well, there you go. That's why it's tricky. And that would happen all the time where no one knew what was going to happen tomorrow and sometimes that afternoon that
wow.
they didn't even have the script. And it wasn't like you could email the script. Right. Curtis Armstrong, who played Herbert Viola and is famous for being in Revenge of the Nerds, he said he would get up at like 5 in the morning and open his front door and just look for a script to see if it was laying there, and he would read what he's going to do that day. That is not how television is made. I mean, I just don't think there's another show that in television history that had this kind of behind the scenes. And because it's been 30 years, everyone was willing to be honest. Like, you know, as you said, warts and all, people came forward and be like, yeah, I probably should have written that script sooner. Or, you know, oops. It's just crazy.
My bad. I thought it was very interesting because the first time I ever saw Curtis Armstrong was in Revenge of the Nerds, and he plays this disgusting character. And then I find out that in one of my favorite episodes, which is the Atomic Shakespeare, it turns out that Curtis Armstrong is actually a Shakespearean trained actor, and that he had really played the role that he is kind of lampooning in the TV episode. And I thought, well, there you go. You should not typecast people because he was not the guy that he played in Revenge of the Nerds any more than he was the guy that he played on Moonlighting. He's an actor, and he is obviously really good at it because he made us think that he was that guy, even though that was just a role he was playing.
Yeah, and when I interviewed him, he was so soft-spoken, so thoughtful, just very, very intelligent. And I, you know, he always plays that crazy, loud character.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
just expected him to be that way, and he wasn't. And he loves Moonlighting so much. And that was great, too, to see, even though he was been in a million things, that this show mattered to him, and he said it was a horrible job as far as like what you're talking about, stress and learning lines and long hours, but the rewards paid off.
As a viewer watching this, realizing something's going on, because all of a sudden we're seeing a lot more Miss DePesto, and then all of a sudden here comes a love interest for her. And that was really fun because they were so sweet together. And Alice Beasley, one of my favorite episodes with her is the first Christmas episode. And she's so sweet and charming all the way through the series. You never got the idea that this was a huge, difficult, stressful thing for her, but apparently it pretty much was, just like it was with all the others when you're not getting scripts on time and things like that. But her work together with Curtis Armstrong was really, really lovely. And it was nice because, as you point out, up to that point, basically it's a two-person show with occasional glimpses of other people who don't really have much to say or much to do, that it's mostly the Dave and Maddie show.
Yeah, and they certainly are the sidekicks. Later, they do an episode where they do the Honeymooners.
Yes.
And, you know, you can kind of think of them as being the other couple. I can't think of their name, not the Cramdons. But
right,
the,
but Ed, you know. Ed Norton and
yeah.
Trixie, was that it? Yeah.
Yes, and Elise even plays Trixie in that thing, and that's pretty much what her character was. Besides, you know, they're the second bananas.
Yeah.
But when Sybil gets pregnant, Bruce breaks his collarbone and leaves to go do Die Hard. You know, all that's left is Elise and Curtis,
right.
And they have to step up, even though America doesn't want it, and you know, they want to see Dave and Maddie, but they weren't available just because of outside circumstances.
We didn't know what was going on behind the scenes, but that was one of the first really dangerous spots for Moonlighting as a television show, as a fan favorite, wasn't it? When all of a sudden we didn't see Maddie and David together in the same episode week after week after week, and All America is wondering what happened. You know, are they not talking to each other? What's the deal? And you go into this in pretty good detail and get the backstory on that in your book.
Yeah, and you know, it's never really been figured out before, and that was another one of my goals. And honestly, to figure it out, I had to piece together these different interviews because nobody could really remember. And somebody would say, oh, it happened this way. And then I'd go back and say, did it happen this way? And they'd be like, no, not quite. It was more like this. And, you know, I felt like I was working on a murder mystery myself, trying to piece together what really happened. Luckily, Jay Daniel, he was the executive producer of the show. Mm-hmm. He kept a diary at the time of what they filmed every day. So I could email him and say, you know, what was going on May 1987, and he would look it up and say, well, it looks like we were doing this episode. So I could kind of piece together how they put together that crazy season where Bruce Willis is off making Die Hard and Sybil is on bed rest with twins.
Yeah, and what is it, and I mean, what made the characters great is that Maddie is not a 20-year-old. You know, she's a grown woman. She's had a, the character had had a career and was now sort of expecting to bask in the glow of success, and then all of a sudden she finds out, nope, got to go back to pounding the boards now, but not as a model. Now I've got to be a detective. Because of that, we forgot that she was a woman and that could have babies, and that if she had a baby, it would be kind of a big deal. And we didn't know, of course, she was pregnant with twins, which made it not only a bigger deal, but also a little more dangerous deal. And all of that was going on behind the scenes. We didn't know it as viewers, but that's what's changing and messing with the chemistry that's going on too. And those kind of interpersonal things could not help but be a problem for the main actors, for Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd.
Right, and then you put on top that the scripts are coming in late, the directors don't have time, and it's just, you know, for a show that is so popular and so many people watched it, it's amazing they ever got an episode done. And the editor said, like, he knew that six times a year he was probably going to be spending the night editing these episodes together, where the show was on Tuesdays at 8, and he said a lot of times we finished them Tuesdays at like 10 in the morning, and we're shooting it over to ABC to try to get it out to all the affiliates.
And this is pre-digital, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, everything's film.
Wow. Wow.
Everything is on film canister, so they're editing it on film, not on their IMAX. And so, you know, those guys, they worked nonstop.
They were the real war horses behind the success of this show. And it's not like the others didn't work hard, but they probably worked even harder than them.
Certainly hourly, definitely, you know, without a doubt.
Yeah.
They were just working nonstop.
Millions and millions of people were watching this series and hung with it, even though when they finally let Dave and Maddie have their moment of passion together, it wasn't really like anybody really wanted it. But that's because of all the other stuff that was going on with them physically. Wasn't Bruce Willis's shoulder was still messed up at this point, and that changes blocking and so forth, and it just made it awkward. But they knew they had to get around to it because they've been teasing us with it for years at that point.
Yeah, and so you have these two characters that everybody was just wanting them to get together, and they want to have this big passionate love scene, and Sybil is pregnant and Bruce has a broken shoulder. So they film their love scene standing up. They put a bed up on the wall. They built a bed on the wall, and they're just standing there because he couldn't support her at all on his shoulder, and you know, she can't lay down and move around and get on top of him because she's pregnant,
right.
And so the majority of that scene, it's a very physical scene because they're rolling around and they're throwing things. It's all doubles, and so that's the other funny thing. You can't really tell. Alan Arkus directed it, and he was nominated for an Emmy for that episode, but man, he should have won, because to block this, you know, 4-minute love scene and hardly any of it is Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd. It's all doubles.
Wow.
So, I mean, just like it's, there's stories like that that I can't believe I'm the first person to like, get to do this book and uncover all of this. That was just such an honor for me.
Some of the great episodes did come early on, but there were good episodes even toward the end. It was so good at the beginning that when it began to slip because of different changes in the management of ABC, career advances of Bruce Willis, the personal things of Sybil Shepherd, all of these things came together. So the quality of the production slipped. People began to think, well, let's just watch something else and we'll catch this in reruns. And that's the death of a show. That was the end of that. 5 years on the air and some incredible stuff. The first season and a half, every single episode is a stunner. It's got new stuff in it. The black and white episode you mentioned where it's introduced by Orson Welles, and it's a fantasy sequence. And there was one episode, gosh, and I forget which one it was. It's in the first season also, I think, or the second, where they're basically doing almost a Dr. Seuss riff back and forth with Dave and Maddie. You know, these kind of things had to be hard. But now you brought up something in your book that I had not heard before, that Bruce Willis apparently was really good at memorizing scripts. He could memorize his lines. He was not just a quick study. He practically was had a mnemonic memory.
Yeah, I don't know if he had it before or it was a talent he had to get because of the way it worked.
Yeah.
But they, you know, quite a few of the people I interviewed said that these long scenes would come out and Bruce would just sort of take a look and be like, yep, 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 yep. And then they would film it. And Sybil was still pretty good. She wasn't quite as quick. She needed a little bit more time. But Sybil told me that anytime they're in the car, there's probably dialogue taped everywhere where you can't see the camera because they probably just got that scene.
Sure.
And well, so they would write it out and tape it and do it that way.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty smart thing to do when you can put things in places so you can remember your lines and keep it fresh. Go for it, you know. Was there anything about moonlighting that you were really shocked to learn?
I think that for me, it was how much the people that worked there needed to talk to me. I mean, I almost felt like our interviews were therapy sessions. Most of the people have never really given an interview about this. And sometimes they've never get an interview in their life because I talked to like some assistants and, you know, anyone I could get,
right,
I interviewed
right.
because I'm trying to get the whole story. And I never had to push them to start talking, no matter who they were, even Sybil Shepherd. I mean, right away they had stories to tell and it was like they were waiting for 30 years for me to call them.
Yeah.
And I would have called them much sooner had I had their numbers.
Absolutely.
So I think that's what surprised me, is that it really mattered to everyone. You know, the one person I interviewed answered the phones, and she told the story about how multiple times someone would call and try to hire Dave and Maddie for their own case. And she said some of these things were horrible, that they really need, you know, their kids are missing or their husband's cheating on them, and they're pouring this out, and they want Dave and Maddie to do it. And she would have to say, like, they're not real. But, I mean, that's how much moonlighting was a part of the culture.
Yeah.
Or how bad our education system is in America. I don't know which one it really is.
It's a combination thereof. What I enjoyed so much about it was learning all this backstory, all these hidden things. And because I'm a huge, huge fan, and I do want to let you know also that I teach a college class for broadcasters called Introduction to Radio and Television, which is basically the history of broadcast. And one of the shows that I feature once we start talking about television and we work our way chronologically has always been moonlighting. I've been teaching the course for 15 years now. We've always talked about moonlighting, and I'd show them bits and pieces of episodes. And this year I decided, you know what? We're going to watch the whole episode. Instead of showing them pieces from the pilot and a little piece of this and a little piece of that. I'm just going to pick one and say, this is the one I'm going to play this semester, and I'll probably play a different one next semester. The kids had never heard of this show. Most of them are 18 to 22 years old, and they just never heard of it. And part of that is that there were problems getting this all on DVD for a long time, and it's hard to find DVD copies of the entire series even now, right?
Yeah, and Glenn is working on trying to get it streaming, but it's all caught up in music rights. But I got to know, what episode did you show?
So I showed him the Christmas from the first season because I loved that. I loved it because it had the nice stuff for Alice Beasley, but I also liked it because of the funny fight at the end when they're getting the bad guys, and then that they break the fourth wall in such a great way with a big sing-along with the families of the cast and crew at the end with fake snow falling on them and all. It's just such a sweet thing, and I thought, that's the one I'm going to show. That's the one, and maybe in the spring and of course it was closer to Christmas, so maybe in the spring I'll show Atomic Shakespeare. That one just cracks me up, but you have to you have to know Shakespeare to understand the gags, or to have seen Taming of the Shrew or Kiss Me Kate, the musical that's based on Taming of the Shrew. If you've seen that.
Do you show your class Twin Peaks?
I haven't really, other than to just say these are the shows that came along toward the end of this. I would be delighted to have some input from you about that. I know that you have the director of A Voyage to Twin Peaks, and also I noticed that you wrote a book about 30-something, which is a show that I enjoyed very much because I was in my 30s when that show was on the air, and so I really identified with the people in there, and of course, like the people who watched Friends when they were in their 20s, they thought, wow, why couldn't my friends be like these guys?
Right.
why couldn't my 30-something buddies be like this? Woo!
Yeah, it's just my next book is about Twin Peaks, so I wasn't sure
if
you cover them.
Probably,
that comes out in May.
Well, then, you know what? We'll do this again in May. And that'll give me the information I need to do a good job presenting Twin Peaks. Awesome.
I love that. And I love that you teach a class about it. I always think of things to show. I always think if I was teaching a class on television, I would use this scene or I would show this.
Yeah.
And I think that was a good pick for Moonlighting. I might show them Big Man on Mulberry Street.
That's not
because
bad.
I think that one is a little more dramatic. It might not be as funny as other ones, but the creativeness in that. But Shakespeare, of course, or the black and white episode. Yeah. Those are all.
Yeah, you can't lose with any of them. That's for sure. Scott, anything else that you wanted to tell us that I foolishly neglected to ask you?
No, just people want to go to the Fayetteville Mafia Press, or my website is scottryanproductions.com. All my books are up there. I love to write about TV, and that's pretty much what I've been doing because I want your students to know that there was this history there. And I think we've got to capture it because now TV is consumed so quickly, but it does matter and it does influence the culture.
Scott Ryan, our guest today, he is the author of Moonlighting and Oral History from Fayetteville Mafia Press. And I want to say thanks very much. I enjoyed the book a lot and enjoyed the chance to talk about it too.
Oh, thank you. It's so fun to talk to a fellow fan, so I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Scott Ryan, the author of Moonlighting, an Oral History from Fayetteville Mafia Press. You can check out scottryanproductions.com. You can also go to Google Fayetteville Mafia Press and see the other books that he has. For example, 30-something at 30, an Oral History, and The Last Days of Letterman, and the book that's coming out in May, which is going to be about Twin Peaks. So we'll be back in touch with Scott Ryan, that's for sure. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We'll have something a little more serious next week, but we thought it would be fun to do something that was just interesting and a little lighthearted today. Thanks for joining us on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and on your favorite radio station. And thanks for listening to WTBF, and you can also check out our website, WTBFradio.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.